Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning into this podcast right now, you know that Democracy Now! Is news you can trust. Democracy Now! Is independent, which means we're funded by you, not the oil, gas, and coal companies when we cover climate change, or the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace, not the insurance industry when we cover health care. No, we're brought to you by viewers, listeners, readers like you, committed to independent information. Right now, a generous supporter will double your donation to Democracy Now! That means if you donate $15, we get $30. Take advantage of this generous offer and go to democracynow.org to make your donation today. Thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And our finding was that Mr. Assange shows all the symptoms of a person who has been exposed to psychological torture for a prolonged period of time. So what we're speaking about is severe stress and constant stress, chronic anxiety, severe psychological trauma.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has concluded WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is suffering from psychological torture due to his ongoing detention and threats of possible extradition to the United States. UN Special Rapporteur Nils Melzer will join us from Geneva, Switzerland. Then we look at the groundbreaking work of the underground feminist abortion service Jane, which operated in the years before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal across the nation.
It was really a time when, if you needed an abortion for whatever reason, you took your life in your hands and you were terrified, absolutely terrified. All you knew was that you might die, that this person didn't know what he was doing and he was going to take hundreds of dollars and you were going to bleed to death in some motel room.
We'll speak to two former members of Jane, Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan, who's also author of the book, The Story of Jane.
Quickly, we realized that the only way for women to have control over this experience was if we took control of the abortion process. And that's what we did.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump said Thursday he'll impose a 5% tariff on Mexican goods and will keep increasing trade sanctions each month until Mexico cracks down on Central American migrants heading for the U.S. border. The announcement caused the Mexican peso to plunge against the dollar, rattled markets around the world, set off fears of a broader trade war. Trump's tariff threat could derail a trade deal known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, negotiated as a successor to NAFTA at Trump's insistence. Trump announced his plans for tariffs just hours after Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador sent lawmakers the renegotiated deal for ratification. In a statement, AMLO condemned Trump's immigration actions and called his slogan, America First, a fallacy. This comes as the Trump administration is reportedly considering a plan to bar anyone who passes through a third country from seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. The move would effectively prevent most Central Americans from exercising their right under international law to seek refuge status in the United States. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports about half of the 2,000 unaccompanied minors imprisoned at U.S. border facilities are there beyond a 72-hour legal limit, with many spending more than a week in Border Patrol stations and processing centers. Louisiana Thursday became the fifth state in the nation to enact a six-week abortion ban when Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards signed the bill that offers no exceptions for rape or incest into law. Meanwhile, Missouri is poised today to become the first state in the nation without a single clinic providing abortions as a judge in St. Louis weighs a last-minute legal challenge to plans by state officials to revoke a medical license for Planned Parenthood's St. Louis clinic. On Thursday, St. Louis police arrested 17 activists activists at a state office building as they held a sit-in protesting, demanding a license renewal. Hundreds more protested outside, chanting, "My body, my choice." This is Kawana Shannon, director of surgical services at Planned Parenthood St. Louis Clinic.
Missouri, please keep your fingers out of our vaginas. Also does vasectomies. Those men are able to come in with no hassle, no problems, no concerns, and they get their vasectomy free of choice with no hurdles to jump over. And then a woman comes in raped by a whole motorcycle gang, and you make her wait 72 hours to think about it.
Five other states have only a single clinic offering abortions: Kentucky, Mississippi, North and South Dakota, and West Virginia. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Laura Kaplan, author of The Story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion surface. Newly surfaced documents reveal a senior Republican strategist who specialized in gerrymandering was secretly behind the Trump administration's efforts to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. When the strategist, Thomas Hoffler, died last August, he left behind a computer hard drive full of his notes and records. Hoffler's estranged daughter found among the documents a 2015 study that concluded adding the citizenship question to the census, quote, would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites and would clearly be a disadvantage to the Democrats, unquote. Census officials have estimated 6.5 million people will not respond to the census if the citizenship question is added. This undercount could affect everything from the redrawing of congressional maps to the allocation of federal funding. In a court filing Thursday, plaintiffs challenging the citizenship question accused two Trump administration officials of falsely testifying under oath about the Justice Department's motivations for altering the census. The Supreme Court is set to rule within weeks on whether Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had the authority to add the citizenship question to the census. In northwestern Syria, a Russian-backed offensive by Syria's military in the last rebel-held province of Idlib has intensified in recent days, prompting hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee toward Turkey, where officials have sealed border crossings, leaving refugees to fend for themselves in squalid camps as fighting rages nearby. The UN said Thursday more than 250,000 residents of Idlib and neighboring Hama province have been displaced by fighting in recent weeks, with reports of at least 160 deaths. The Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations says the toll is even higher, with at least 229 civilians killed and over 700 wounded. North Korea has reportedly executed its special envoy to the United States after President Trump walked away from a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in February without a deal on denuclearization. A major South Korean newspaper reports the envoy, Kim Hok-chol, was shot to death by a firing squad in March at an airport outside Pyongyang, along with four other North Korean foreign ministry officials, and that a translator at the summit was sent to a forced labor camp for committing a translation mistake. This comes as Kim's sister is said to be lying low on her brother's orders in the wake of the summit's collapse. She hasn't been seen since then. Colombia's Supreme Court's ordered the release of Jesus Santrich, a senior guerrilla commander turned elected official, saying the former rebel could be sworn in as a congressman under the terms of Colombia's 2016 peace accord, which ended more than a half century of civil war. The agreement grants limited amnesty to FARC rebels who lay down arms and confess crimes, including immunity to extradition. Santrich had been jailed at the request of the Trump administration, which is seeking to try him for cocaine trafficking based on an indictment by federal prosecutors in New York. Santrich's release was a rare rebuke of the Trump administration by the right-wing government of President Iván Duque. Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernández was targeted by the Drug Enforcement Administration in a large-scale drug trafficking and money laundering probe that began in 2013. Court documents filed by prosecutors in Manhattan earlier this week are part of an ongoing case against Hernández's brother, Juan Antonio Tony Hernández, who was arrested in Miami in November. He's awaiting trial. Eight others were also named in the court documents, including the Honduran Security Minister, Julian Pacheco. President Hernández is denying the charges. Hernández is a key U.S. ally in and Central America. The Trump administration recognized his 2017 victory in an election that was marred by widespread allegations of fraud. Meanwhile, protests are continuing in Honduras against plans by President Hernandez to privatize health care, pensions and education. Thousands of teachers, medical workers and students flooded the streets of Tegucigalpa again Thursday, closing the capital city's airport and drawing tear gas from police.
I am here because people are suffering, because I have students who don't have anything to eat, who come to class hungry. That's
in Brazil,
why I'm here.
Hundreds of thousands of students took to the streets of Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo, and other cities and towns nationwide Thursday in a massive protest against plans by the far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, to dramatically slash education spending. Bolsonaro dismissed similar protests earlier this month, calling student demonstrators imbeciles and useful idiots. In Bangladesh, police have charged 16 people over the murder of Nusrat Jahan Rafi, a 19-year-old woman who was burned to death at her school after she filed a sexual assault complaint against her headmaster. The case has brought renewed attention to the plight of sexual assault survivors in Bangladesh and the impunity often granted to perpetrators of sexual violence. A police investigator said he'll recommend all 16 of those charged with Rafi's murder face the death penalty. Back in the United States, President Trump ramped up his attacks on Special Counsel Robert Mueller Thursday, appearing to inadvertently admit that Russia helped get him elected in 2016. Trump tweeted, quote, "Russia, Russia, Russia. That's all you heard at the beginning of this witch hunt hoax. And now Russia has disappeared because I had nothing to do with Russia helping me get elected." Speaking to reporters on the White House lawn, Trump later backtracked from the claim, saying Russia did not help me get elected. At the Chicago Board of Trade, commodity prices for corn and soybeans have soared in recent days as severe weather is continuing to hamper the spring planting season. Farmers across the central U.S. report flooding and an unprecedented string of deadly tornadoes has left millions of acres of farmland impossible to sow. Environmentalist Bill McKibben tweeted, quote, "Normally at this point in the season, 90% of America's corn crop is in the ground. But thanks to the endless rain, it's 58% this year. For soybeans, 29% planted instead of the usual 66%. A hotter planet equals more rain and more drought and horribly stressed farmers," he tweeted. On Capitol Hill, a lone Republican lawmaker blocked a bill Thursday to provide more than $19 billion in disaster relief to U.S. states and territories hit by earthquakes, as well as hurricanes, wildfires, and other natural disasters exacerbated by climate change. Tennessee Republican Congressmember John Rose denied unanimous consent to the bill, declaring it too expensive. It's the third time the bill was halted by Republicans on procedural grounds. The bill is virtually certain to pass next week when congressmembers return to Washington. It came together after President Trump dropped his demand that lawmakers attach $4.1 billion in border security funding to the legislation. New Hampshire became the 21st state to outlaw the death penalty Thursday as lawmakers voted to override a veto by Republican Governor Chris Sununu. New Hampshire hasn't carried out an execution in 80 years and is just one prisoner on death row. In Washington, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform will hold a hearing on D.C. statehood next month. It's the first time in a quarter century that a House committee has taken up the issue. In a new Washington Post op-ed, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer declared his support for statehood, writing, quote, "I was hesitant about D.C. statehood. Now I believe it's the only path forward." In California, a military judge in San Diego ordered Navy SEAL Special Operations Chief Edward Gallagher freed from custody Thursday, citing prosecutorial misconduct in Gallagher's murder trial for alleged war crimes. The judge ruled prosecutors exceeded their authority when they tried to plant computer code in emails in order to find the source of leaks about the case. The court has yet to rule on whether to remove prosecutors or to throw out the case entirely. Gallagher is accused of shooting unarmed civilians in Mosul, Iraq, and killing a wounded captive ISIS teenager fighter by stabbing him with a knife, then staging a reenlistment ceremony over the dead teenager's body. President Trump signaled he's considering a presidential pardon for Gallagher and other military members convicted of war crimes. And Harold Wilson, who spent 17 years in prison, most of it on death row, for a crime he did not commit, died May 18th from complications of a stroke. He was 61 years old. In 1989, Harold Wilson was convicted of a triple murder and sentenced to death by a Pennsylvania jury. A decade later, Wilson's death sentence was overturned due to ineffective counsel. However, his murder convictions were not reversed, and he remained on death row for years. Finally, in October of 2005, Wilson won a new trial and was acquitted of all charges after DNA evidence proved his innocence. Speaking to Democracy Now! Just after his exoneration, Wilson said he was released with 65 cents and a bus token.
It's like, you know, after 18 years of dealing with the injustice system, all the abuse, the physical, mental abuse, I'm placed back in society with nothing. Just you know what I mean, the shelter of family. You know, no means of livelihood, no means of support. No financial bank accounts, no credit card, no compensation whatsoever.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture is warning that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is suffering from the effects of psychological torture due to his ongoing detention and threats of possible extradition to the United States. The UN expert, Nils Melzer, also warned Assange would likely face a politicized show trial if he were to be extradited to the United States. Melzer writes, quote, "In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, I've never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time." Melzer spoke to reporters this morning in Geneva, Switzerland.
And our finding was that Mr. Assange shows all the symptoms of a person who has been exposed to psychological torture for a prolonged period of time. So what we're speaking about is severe stress and constant stress, a chronic anxiety, severe psychological trauma. The psychiatrist that accompanied my admission said that his state of health was critical, and if he did not get urgent relief, that we would have to expect a rapid deterioration of that state of health, and possibly with irreparable harm.
Julian Assange is currently serving a 50-week sentence for skipping bail in 2012 at London's Belmarsh prison after he was forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy where he lived for 7 years by British police last month. Last week, the U.S. Justice Department announced it was charging Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act for his role in publishing U.S. classified military and diplomatic documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The documents were leaked by U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. This is the first time a journalist or publisher has been charged under the World War I-era Act. Assange, who'd already been charged on one count of hacking a government computer, now faces up to 170 additional years in prison in the U.S. under the new charges, 10 years for each count of violating the Espionage Act. Julian Assange was due to appear by video link before a magistrate's court on Thursday, but failed to appear, reportedly due to health problems. Assange's attorney, Jennifer Robinson, appeared on Democracy Now! Last week and spoke about his deteriorating health.
I'm very concerned about the ongoing health issues that he has and whether he's getting adequate medical treatment here within the British prison system. He's finding it very difficult. He's very isolated. And I think the prospect of a very long extradition fight and potential extradition to the United States is a real concern. But of course, he is resolved to fight this. As he said at his first extradition hearing, he refused to consent to extradition to the United States because he would not be extradited for doing journalism. And this case raises, as we've seen from the free speech groups that have come out overnight, this case raises fundamental questions of free speech, which is why he is resolved to absolutely fighting this extradition.
We go now to Geneva, Switzerland, where we're joined by Nils Melzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you begin by telling us the results of your report and describing your visit to see Julian Assange at the Belmarsh prison in London?
Yeah, thank you, Amy. Well, I did visit Mr. Assange in prison, Belmarsh Prison, on the 9th of May in the company of two medical experts. And my primary concerns really are that I'm extremely worried about his current state of health, which was alarming already when I visited him, and which seems to have deteriorated rapidly since then, to the point where he's no longer even able to stand trial and to participate in court hearings. I must say that I'm appalled at the sustained and concerted abuse that this man has been exposed to at the hands of several democratic states over a period of almost a decade. And I'm gravely concerned about the prospects of a possible extradition to the United States. As I have indicated this morning in Geneva, I worry that he would be exposed to a politicized show trial in violation of his human rights.
So talk about your role as UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. What is the significance of the report you put out? Who pays attention to it? Is it legally binding in any way?
Now, my role is that of a rapporteur. I have been mandated by the United Nations to report to all UN member states about their compliance with the prohibition of torture and ill treatment. So I examined this case and I reported my concerns to the involved governments, which is now primarily the UK government, but also the Ecuadorian, the United States, and the Swedish government, which have each contributed in my assessment to the medical effects that we have observed now.
Christine Assange, Julian Assange's mother, tweeted, "The UK government is unlawfully slowly killing my son. They made him very ill by refusing him any access to life-sustaining fresh air, exercise, sun, vitamin D, or proper medical care for 6 years of illegal embassy detention. Then, against all medical advice, threw him into a prison cell." She tagged the UN in her post. Talk about your visit with him. Talk about the time he was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He was there for almost 7 years, was not able to go outside because the British government said they would arrest him if he did.
Yes. Well, I think it's very important to say that I went to the prison with two very experienced and specialized medical experts. So experts that are specialized in examining and in identifying and documenting symptoms of torture, physical torture or psychological torture. And we ran medical protocols called the Istanbul Protocol, which are recognized protocols to examine torture victims to have an objective medical assessment. So Mr. Assange showed all the symptoms that are typical for persons that have been exposed to prolonged psychological torture. And my assessment is that Mr. Assange has been exposed to various forms of cruel and human and degrading treatment that cumulatively have the same effect as psychological torture. Now, because Mr. Assange has been confined to a very controlled environment for about 7 years, with very little outside influence, it is possible to identify the causal relationship between the medical symptoms and the actual causes of these symptoms with a high degree of certainty. Now, our conclusions are that, first of all, it is the concerted effort of various states to hand him over to the United States, which is a bit of the elephant in the room. That's the one fear he has had since 2010, when he first published large amounts of compromising information about the United States. And soon after, he was then exposed to a relentless campaign of judicial persecution, I'd say, because it is an abuse of the judicial system in order to try to extradite him to the U.S. and get him to be prosecuted for a row of offenses, as we have now seen under the Espionage Act. I believe that Mr. Assange has a credible case and a credible fear that he would not get a fair trial in the United States, and that he would not be safe and protected from the types of detention and treatment that would violate the Convention Against Torture. So he has, in the same time, at the same time from 2010, then increasingly been exposed to a public campaign of, or a campaign of public mobbing, I would say, mobbing, vilification, and intimidation, ranging from deliberate ridicule to insults and up to actually open calls for his assassination and murder, without the governments, the concerned governments, ever interfering and trying to protect him from this type of unacceptable threats. Now, all of these elements have contributed, obviously, to a level of stress and anxiety that would be unbearable for anyone. But on top of this, when the new government was elected in Ecuador in 2017, the last government that had actually provided him with refuge and protection turned against him and started to deliberately harass him in order to get him to leave the embassy and or to trigger a health crisis that would justify his expulsion to a British hospital and therefore to British jurisdiction. So all these elements have resulted in a medical picture and symptoms that are tantamount to what psychological torture would produce over a prolonged period.
The British Foreign Minister, Jeremy Hunt, has responded to your report by saying, quote, "This is wrong. Assange chose to hide in the embassy and was always free to leave and face justice. The UN Special Rapporteur should allow British courts to make their judgments without his interference or inflammatory accusations." Niels Melzer, your response.
Well, I have responded to him, and I said that, with all due respect, sir, but Mr. Assange was about to as free to leave as someone who is sitting on a rubber boat in a shark pool. I believe it is important to see that the Swedish prosecution, the Ecuadorian authorities, and also the UK judicial authorities so far have not shown the impartiality and objectivity that is required under the rule of law. He has been expelled from the Ecuadorian embassy without any due process of law, and we're talking about the formal lifting of an asylum status and the suspension of his nationality citizenship, which normally would not be done, obviously, by a president on a new unilateral decision, but this would be a court proceeding where the defendant or the concerned person would have a right to defend himself. The way the Swedish prosecution has been conducted also shows that Mr. Assange was not given the opportunity to defend himself properly in public against allegations of sexual offense without at the same time having to expose himself to a possible extradition to the United States, which obviously is not related to the sexual offenses. But he was not given the opportunity to do so. So for 10 years, his reputation and credibility and his human dignity have been gravely affected by these allegations, and the Swedish prosecution deliberately prevented him from actually taking an official position against that. Now, in the UK courts, we have seen a similar type of bias. He was, the same day he was dragged out of the embassy after more than 6 years, and the same day he was pulled into a UK court, he was given reportedly less than 15 minutes with his defense lawyer to prepare a defense, and then in a very short hearing was convicted for bail violation, and the judge even insulted him as being a narcissist who cannot get beyond himself. Now, as a lawyer, having worked at court myself, I cannot imagine how a judge could come to such a conclusion when the defendant didn't say anything else in that hearing than, "I plead not guilty." So I believe we have to take a step back and look at all these proceedings, how they have been conducted, and come to our own conclusions whether these are fair. We also have to take a step back and look at this whole narrative of suspected rapist, narcissist, selfish, ungrateful person, hacker, and scratch the surface a little bit and see what's below there. When I was first approached by his defense team to seeking protection from my mandate in December last year, I was reluctant to do so because me too, I had been affected by this prejudice that I had absorbed through all these public, you know, narratives spread in the media over the years. And only when I scratched the surface a little bit, I saw how little foundation there was to back this up and how much fabrication and manipulation there is in this case. So I encourage everybody to really look below the surface in this case.
And finally, Niels Melzer, what Julian Assange would face in this country, in the United States, if he were extradited here, a country that has the death penalty. Talk about the trial, what you see. You've talked about the elephant in the room.
Yes, I'm gravely, gravely concerned. I'm almost, certain that he would not get a safe, a fair trial and a safe treatment in the United States. The public prejudice, including on the part of former and current officials in the United States, has been so predominant for several years now, and so that it would be almost impossible to have an impartial court hearing where he could actually be heard with his concerns. When we see the charges that have been added now recently under the Espionage Act, most of them really relate to activities that any investigative journalist is conducting every day. So it's really a reason for concern for press freedom around the world. Then we are also, with the United States, unfortunately dealing with a country that in the last 20 years has not shown to be consistent in enforcing the prohibition of torture with its own officials. We can speak to the Senate committee report that has not led to a single prosecution contrary to their obligations under the Convention Against Torture. Obviously, the collateral murder video has not led to any prosecutions either. The only person that is being prosecuted here seems to be the one that actually exposed all of these crimes. And so, in this type of context, it is almost not conceivable that a person like Mr. Assange could ever be acquitted and ever get a fair court trial.
And any kind of guarantee that he would not receive the death penalty?
Well, I would expect the United States to respect its own assurances. But, it's the death penalty is one concern. But on the other hand, if someone gets sentenced to basically life without parole or 170 or 180 years in prison, which would be equivalent to that, for having conducted investigative journalism, then that really would amount in itself to a cruel and unusual punishment. I would say that would be in violation of international law, but also of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
And finally, what are you calling for, Neil Smelser?
Well, I think, first of all, the four countries that I appealed to, that I've written formal letters to, should recognize that the way they handled this affair violated the Convention Against Torture, that they have to stop in their tracks. They have to really investigate the circumstances to lead to this situation and then also, obviously, take measures for remedy. If Mr. Assange really has committed a criminal offense, obviously he will have to respond for that. But then he has to be given the chance to develop a defense, have sufficient contact with his lawyers, and receive the guarantees that his human rights are really protected. He cannot be tried in an environment that is severely prejudiced and shows only bias against him. My personal recommendation would simply be to release him because he has already suffered enough. But I, as a lawyer, I can acknowledge that there may be a formal requirement to conduct certain proceedings, but it is extremely important that his human rights are now being respected, that there is an independent observation of how these trials are being conducted, and especially that his medical state of health be stabilized and he's given sufficient time to recover, to regain strength, to be able to face whatever he has to face.
And again, those four countries, United States, Britain, Ecuador, and Sweden, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Melzer, has accused them of collective persecution. Niels Melzer, I want to thank you very much for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Human Rights Chair of the Geneva Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights, Professor of International Law at University of Glasgow, and author of several books on international law. For our interviews with Julian Assange, go to democracynow.com. When we come back, we look at the incredible history of the underground feminist abortion service Jane, which operated in the years before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal across the country. We'll speak with two of the former members of the Jane Collective. Stay with us.
self-destruct.
Nail-biting song by Anna McClellan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, Louisiana became the fifth state to ban abortions after 6 weeks when the Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards, signed the new measure into law. The law does not include exceptions for rape or incest. However, the ban will go into effect if neighboring Mississippi's abortion ban is upheld. A federal judge temporarily blocked the Mississippi ban last week. In addition to Louisiana and Mississippi, Kentucky, Ohio, and Georgia have also recently moved to outlaw abortions after 6 weeks, while Missouri passed an 8-week abortion ban earlier this week. Alabama's passed a near-total ban on abortions. Architects of the recent wave of draconian abortion laws say they're aimed at overturning Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling that recognizes the constitutional right to an abortion. Well, before the landmark Roe ruling in 73, women in many parts of the country who were seeking abortions turned to oftentimes dangerous alternative solutions. In 1969, a group of women in Chicago decided to take matters into their own hands, setting up a hotline offering counseling and providing abortion services under the moniker Jane. This is an excerpt of the 1996 documentary Jane, an abortion service. It's directed by Kate Kurtz and Nell Lundy.
I went to a doctor who just treated me like dirt. He said, if you girls would keep your legs together, you wouldn't have to be coming in here until after you got married.
Doctor, I need help.
I remember saying to the doctor, after paying him all the money I had, what am I supposed to do? And his response was, well, you've got to go out there and find the father, and, you know, he's going to have to marry you.
It was really a time when, if you needed an abortion for whatever reason, you took your life in your hands, and you were terrified, absolutely terrified. All you knew was that you might die, that this person didn't know what he was doing, and he was going to take hundreds of dollars, and you were going to bleed to death in some motel room.
I thought my life was going to be making souffles and setting exquisite tables and cooking wonderful gourmet food and just being the perfect hostess for whatever lifestyle we were going to have. If somebody had told me that I was going to get arrested for abortion and conspiracy to commit abortion 10 years later, I'd have said they were out of their minds.
In 1965, after I'd returned from Mississippi, a friend of mine said that his sister was pregnant and was very frightened and was looking for a doctor to perform an abortion. And while I had never really thought about the issue before and wasn't sure what to do either, I made some calls and contacts and located a physician who was willing to perform an abortion.
Abortion was illegal. The hospital and doctors wanted no part of any abortion and were not willing to even see you if they're suspecting an abortion. So a woman bleeding and possibly dying could be sent away from a hospital.
Everybody I knew, everybody I talked to who had become pregnant and didn't want to have a baby and had tried to abort, had done something really painful or horrible, and they were all hysterical and desperate, just like I was, just hysterical, desperate, scared.
Several months later, word of that had spread, and someone else contacted me. And then several months later, word had spread again, and someone else contacted me. And I realized that there was a real need out there. And I decided to set up a system for talking with women who were trying to figure out what to do. And I set up what became known as the service, or Jane.
That last voice, Heather Booth, from an excerpt of the 1996 documentary Jane, an Abortion Service, directed by Kate Kurtz and Nell Lundy, distributed by Women Make Movies. By the time Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973, the Jane Collective had performed an estimated 11,000 abortions. We're joined now by two former members of Jane, Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan. Laura is also the author of the book, The Story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service, which was recently reprinted. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! So, day after day now, abortion bans are being passed around the country. It's not that those who want these bans in place necessarily think that lower courts will keep them in place. But they want one of these cases to get to the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. As you watch this, Laura Kaplan, taking place around the country, your thoughts and what it means to have been active around this issue before Roe v. Wade existed?
Well, it's really horrifying. It's just this giant leap backwards in terms of the respect for women and women's decisions. It's horrifying. You know, I'm just amazed every day.
Talk about how you got involved with Jane.
Well, it's great that Alice is here, because Alice is the reason I got involved with Jane. I had moved back to Chicago. I'd gone to school there and then moved back to New York, where I'm from, and moved back to Chicago in 1971. And shortly thereafter, my dear friend from college, Alice, found out she was pregnant. So do you want her to tell her story?
Yeah, I do.
Hi there. At that time, there was no question of me remaining pregnant. I was in a new relationship, and abortion was already legal in New York, so I knew I had enough knowledge to know that that was an option for me. And it was clearly, it was not a decision I had trouble making, that I needed to have an abortion at that time. I was fresh out of college myself. And interestingly, and I'm not sure I remember my thinking around that time, it didn't really occur to me to come to New York. I really was in an independent state of mind and felt I could take care of my own life, and saw an ad about pregnant, called Jane. And immediately I felt confident, and from that initial interaction over the telephone.
What did you say? You called up,
I
said
called
you were
that
pregnant,
number.
And what did the person say? Who
I
was
think it?
It
was a message. The first one was, please leave your name and maybe the date of your last period. I don't remember what the actual information was that I left on that time. But I was called back pretty promptly. I don't recall being in a state of waiting very long. And I then met with a counselor at that time. And she gave me all the information about what would happen. And I was in her home with her young children running around. And I felt totally comfortable, confident, not frightened. You know, I hear these stories of what the worry and the fear that what lay ahead was some nightmare. I don't recall feeling that for a moment. And I felt very proud of myself for taking care of myself.
And what happened? What did she do in this home with her kids?
So she laid out to me exactly what would happen in the procedure that I would be taken care of, that I would exactly all the steps that would happen, that I would be driven to a place that would be that I would be safe and taken care of, that someone would be by my side the whole time, and that she described the procedure itself, which at that time was DNC, and that I would be, I think I was taken with a group of women so that I wasn't by myself. There was a few women, maybe Laura can correct me, but that's my memory, that there were a few people each time that procedure was scheduled. And she described the procedure in detail, which again was an incredibly, I don't think I'd ever been described a medical procedure before by someone saying this is exactly what's going to happen, and I was prepared.
We're going to go to break, and we come back. We're going to hear the voices of women who, like you, went through this. This abortion service Jane put in place so that women would not have to go to backstreet alleys. But the people involved with this abortion service were not doctors themselves. We're talking to Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan, both members of the Jane Collective. Laura Kaplan wrote about this in her book, The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. Stay with us.
There is a song for every voice, comfort in words to sing. Give me your hand, together we'll reap the most beautiful garden you've ever seen. There is a place we have yet to know, one that we speak of but haven't roamed. Give me your hand, let's take the leap. Tell our sisters and brothers, home is here with me. There is a sinner inside us all. There is a giver who's taken the fall.
The Most Beautiful Garden, featured in the film Ask for Jane, about the Jane Collective. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Ask for Jane. Those were the magic words that provided thousands of women access to safe abortions before the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling in 1973 that guaranteed the constitutional right to abortion. With abortion services outlawed in most of the United States, women often had to risk their lives in order to terminate a pregnancy. So in 1969, a group of women in Chicago decided to take matters into their own hands, setting up a hotline, offering counseling, and actually providing abortion services under the name Jane. This is Heather Booth, who founded Jane when she was a college student at University of Chicago. Here she is in the 1996 documentary, Jane, an Abortion Service.
The people who called in the early years, it was mostly a student network. First at the University of Chicago, then from other Chicago-based schools, and then on through other campuses in the Midwest. And my recollection is that I was receiving some of these calls when I was living in a dormitory. And I told people who called to ask for Jane. So it was anonymous.
With time, activists with Jane went from referring women for abortions to performing the abortions themselves. Here's another clip from the documentary.
First, there was a physical level of involvement.
Drop them off, and then one of Mike's people would pick them up and blindfold them and take them to a building where the abortion would be done, and then they would be dropped back off.
A lot of guys who do abortions come on to the women and are abusive, either on moral and ethical grounds, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it, like, oh, you got yourself in trouble, or you're a bad girl, or, you know, that kind of thing, or the sexual approach. Our guy, none of that.
He came from, I don't even think working class, I think even poorer than working class. And the kind of way you don't trust anybody and everybody's out for themselves.
The first thing he said, I guess he said to Ruth and to me both, was we can't meet together, only two of us at a time, because if more than two meet, it's a conspiracy. So first he and Ruth go off and have their little chat, and then they say, okay, Ruth comes in and says, okay, you can go down now, and I go off alone with him, and we just talked money. I said, look, let's talk money. And he said, that's what I want to talk about. And we struck a deal right away. I said, come down on your price. And he says, no, we're not coming down below 500.
All of us women, I'm sure, felt that the fee of $500 or $1,000 was extraordinarily exploitative and made it impossible for a lot of people to get abortions who needed them. So when it became clear that this was not an especially difficult thing to do, pressure was put on him to teach us, say, hey, you know, look, this looks like something we could do. And amazingly, he thought it was too, and that wasn't such a bad idea.
The blindfolds came off, and the prices were coming down, and those of us who had known him the longest were also beginning to learn. And very quickly, training others of us. So that I, who had come in October of 70, by the beginning of 71, was one of the people who had already begun to do long-term abortions on an extra day that we added where we were the only staff. We didn't have him. It was just us.
What we did was we broke the bag of waters and pushed out the water, and then over a period of time, the fetus would die. And the woman would miscarry.
After I took the instrument in my hand, you know, he said, here, feel what it feels like. Here's the feeling you're looking for. And man, I could close my eyes and I could feel it exactly the feeling. And I thought, I can do this. And all of a sudden, this just vista opened up.
Also, somewhere in that period, the group discovered, I don't know if discovered is the right word. I'm not quite sure what the right verb is here. It was known suddenly that he was not an MD.
And then Mike was gone.
Well, he'd already made enough money. The mafia had moved in on him. Also, he believed in what we were doing.
A clip from the documentary Jane, an abortion service directed by Kate Kurtz and Nell Lundy, distributed by Women Make Movies. Still with us, the two former members of Jane, Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan. Laura Kaplan has also written the book, The Story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service, which was recently reprinted. This service went on for about 4 years until Roe v. Wade became the law of the land. Talk about the bust of the women, the police moving in Chicago on this abortion service. Again, abortions performed by women, not doctors, who were fearful that if women didn't have something like this when abortion was illegal, that they could die from back alley abortions. Laura.
You want to talk specifically about the bust. So the bust happened on a very lovely May day. And what we found out was that a sister-in-law of a woman scheduled had come with her. We encouraged people to come with someone to the counseling session in their counselor's home. So this woman had brought her sister-in-law, who didn't like what she heard. So she went to her precinct. And so the police followed the driver. As Alice described, we had people gather at a place called a front, which was a front. And then in small groups, they were driven to another apartment or house that we called the place, because that's where we did the abortions, very creative with names. So the police followed the driver a couple of times, and then they barged in while we were working, and they wanted to know where the man was and where the money was. And of course, there wasn't much in the way of money. We charged $100. We got probably an average of $40, $40 or $50 per person. And there was no man. It was just us. So they arrested everybody who was at the place. They then went to the front and arrested everybody there. So they had a police station full of because we had people bring whoever they wanted with them to the front. And so there were children and husbands and mothers and friends and, you know, quite a large group of people in the police station.
How many of you were charged?
Seven.
And you were charged with? Jane members
abortion and conspiracy to commit abortion.
Facing how many years?
Homicide squad detectives were the ones who busted us. A lot of years.
Final thoughts, Alice. Of course, this case was dropped when Roe v. Wade became the law of the land.
In light of everything now, it's amazing to kind of look back at that time and to see that it was sort of part of a very active political time in all of our lives. We had come, I mean, this was the
early. Do you see women going back to this?
Well, I it's hard to imagine that we would have to go back to this, but I also think that having gone into healthcare for many years, that it was an incredible example.
Well, we're going to leave it here for now. We're going to do part two and put it in web exclusives at democracynow.org. Laura Kaplan, Alice Fox, members of Jane, Laura Kaplan's book, The Story of Jane. We're going to end, though, today's show with a piece from StoryCorps about Dr. George Tiller, the abortion provider assassinated 10 years ago today while attending church in Wichita, Kansas. These are the voices of Rabbi David Young and cantor Natalie Young, who went to see Dr. Tiller in 2006.
I loved being pregnant. It was an amazing feeling.
The ultrasound where we found out that there was something wrong was supposed to be the last thing before going in and delivering a beautiful baby boy. And the tech said, uh-oh. I remember them saying that it would be impossible for him to survive outside the womb and that he would likely be brain dead. It was two horrible choices. Having a third-term abortion or have to wait the last month of pregnancy knowing that we were going to have to give birth to a baby who could not live.
Yeah.
It would have been torture.
Within a couple of days, we were on a plane to Wichita. I remember arriving at Dr. Tiller's office and having all of these protesters outside, and I felt like this was the last place we wanted to be. I remember us meeting Dr. Tiller, who was so kind and so sorry that we were there.
He kept reminding us that nobody wanted to be there.
And that it wasn't our fault.
And that it wasn't our fault.
Which I kept needing to hear.
He made sure that we knew he had kids of his own and grandkids of his own.
And that he was a man of faith.
Yeah.
And so to be able to connect in that way, I thought was really comforting.
And I don't even know if you know that every day when we got back to the hotel and you were sleeping, Dr. Tiller called me to check on you. While we both felt a sense of loss, I think we also felt a sense of gratitude that we could allow Elijah to rest in peace and not have to struggle.
When I read about some person shooting Dr. Tiller, I totally freaked out.
I think I was in my office and you called me and told me, and I was stunned.
I was so angry. And I thought about other couples who were probably there that week. What were they going to do? How did that change their lives?
There's nothing about this experience that would fit on a picket sign or on a political campaign slogan. It's way too complicated for that. And every single person has their own unique story, just like ours.
Yeah.
People he's helped.
I want him to be remembered as a compassionate and courageous man who was there to help people during the darkest times in their lives.
He was so deeply needed by so many people.
That was Rabbi David Young and his wife, cantor Natalie Young, speaking to StoryCorps, remembering Dr. George Tiller, an abortion provider in Wichita, Kansas, who was assassinated 10 years ago today in church. The piece produced by Aisha Turner. That does it for our show. Today, our condolences to our dear colleague, Democracy Now! Producer Carla Wills, on the passing of her older brother, Richard Eugene Wells, Jr. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.